I don't need to remind this audience or go into a long theoretical introduction because you're probably familiar with the field, perhaps more than I am. But aside from the photograph being disseminated and goes into the market and used by various people whom will assign new meanings to it, the production of the photograph involves many elements: personal, social, political, artistic, aesthetic, etc. In the production of a photograph that I would like to look at, I usually think of the history of the photographer. Who was the photographer? Why did he or she take that photograph? That's one context. The other one, who was a sponsoring institution? The government or the agency or the whatever research center or news organization? And what did they want from that photograph? I also take into account who are the people or were the people represented in the photograph and what was their relationship to the photographer and to the sponsoring institution. The kind of relationship of power. Were they just merely there to be photographed, or was there an attempt to get them to speak through the photograph? And of course, I look at the historical context in which the photograph was produced. I am going to look at the photographs of Palestinian refugees that were produced by the United Nations agency, which I will talk about in a minute. Let me start by reminding you that in 1948, Palestine ceased to exist. It simply disappeared from the map. Its people, as we see in those photojournalistic images published in Time magazine in April 1948, its people, they are now in that image over there. They are in the liminal space between being citizens and becoming refugees. They're in the boat about to leave Haifa, April 28, 1948. Under the watchful eye, of course, of the British soldiers who were still ruling Palestine for the next couple weeks in this case. The people who left Palestine were largely expelled, even if they fled because of fear that something will happen to them. They were either directly or indirectly expelled, as this picture again from the city of Haifa, again in the end of April 1948, shows the Haganah fighters. Haganah was the Zionist paramilitary force, pre-state force, escorting the refugees towards the harbor. And we can see also in the Haifa bus station on the same day by the same photojournalist, the casualties, the dead Palestinians at the time, which was part of terrorizing the population into leaving. So that we know. Now, the refugees, which at the time were roughly more than two-thirds of the Palestinian population, the population of Palestine who turned into refugees, presented a humanitarian crisis. And therefore, international agencies concerned with humanitarian issues got involved. And here we see this picture from the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva from 1949 of the beginnings of a refugee camp now in the West Bank, well, now and then, called the Jelazon, where the agency, through its records, talks about the tents they provided, etc. Other agencies like the Quakers, American Quakers, took control of refugee camps or the refugee welfare in Gaza for a short time period, until eventually the United Nations decided to create a special agency known as the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, with the acronyms UNRWA, which I will be using. And this agency, as the UN resolution, General Assembly resolution states, it will basically, don't need to read you, will take care of the refugees until they managed to return in accordance with another UN resolution that was issued a few months, about a year before this got confused, because the other one is on December 2nd, but 48, not 49. This agency basically, I mean, there was a failure to create a Palestinian state among this whole chaos. The UN did not, or the occupying power, colonial power, or Britain did not help the Palestinians set the structure for creating a state. So Palestinians disappeared. They were now under the custody of UNRWA. They don't have their own institutions. And the UNRWA started to call them Arab refugees. So even the word Palestine itself disappeared from the vocabulary. In 1952, a woman who was hired by UNRWA, a British woman who was hired by the UNRWA agency to be a speechwriter, was sent to write reports to the General Secretary of the UNRWA and the General Secretary of the UN about the conditions of the new camps that UNRWA was now setting up, collecting the refugees in the neighboring countries and in what was left of Palestine, and placing them in certain refugee camps, providing them with tents and medical service and some basic education. So the woman, her name is Myrtle Winter, happened to visit this camp in the north of Lebanon called Nahr al-Barid. Nahr al-Barid is the name of a river, so it's next to the river called al-Barid. And she happened to have her Leica camera on her, so she climbed on a pole, electric pole, and took this picture and submitted it with her report, which really fascinated the picture, fascinated her supervisors, and they decided that we should, along with our reports, include pictures. So Myrtle Winter was entrusted with establishing a photo department for UNRWA. And she gathered the few employees she had in her office as a speechwriter, including the guy who was making coffee and tea, including the janitor, and trained them in photography. And some of them today are among the most well-known photographers, at least of the 50s and 60s and 70s in the Arab world. And those were, depending on what area, they were Palestinians, they were Lebanese, they were Jordanians, depending, you know, locals who worked in different offices or areas where UNRWA was working at the time. So therefore, from there on, we have a photo archive, a massive photo archive, which over time developed into very much an institutional activity, where UNRWA to this day, 70 years later, sends photographers every 3 years, was established, I don't know why 3 years, to document the refugee camps that they take care of at the time. The photographs constitute a massive archive on the Palestinians, perhaps the largest archive, I cannot be certain, but perhaps the largest archive that exists on Palestinian life in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and up to date. Certainly, it is the largest when it comes to 50s, 60s, and 70s. Maybe today we have other archives or other collections, I don't know. But the point is that today, in the absence of Palestinian archive, in the absence of Palestinian institutions, this is the archive that became the source for many Palestinian artistic, political, propaganda, you know, activities, where if they wanted pictures, they will go to this massive collection of the UNRWA archives. The photographs taken by Myrtle or her boys, as she called them, when I last interviewed her, basically focused on the living conditions in the camps, with images of, you know, schooling, tent here that is a classroom, with the medical services that UNRWA was providing the Palestinian refugees, and included, I liked what Margaret called yesterday, I'm trying to remember, was it refugee porn, so included refugee porn, I suppose, were, you know, the sad eyes, and those images were used to solicit funds for the UNRWA, not only from governments, but also from individuals. Some of the images tended to resemble, I mean, I think the photographers sometimes were inspired by something else they wanted to try to capture. They were useless for the institutional purposes to take images like portrait of this guy here who in the 1970s lost his family in a refugee camp in Lebanon, or the Madonna kind of Madonna and Child kind of image. But one would think that, you know, there was a margin of freedom for the photographers to occasionally stray off the official line, and that we see it in Myrtle's obsession with women with jars. We see this often in her collection, almost in every location. And the refugee camps are in Lebanon, in Jordan, in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Syria. So, you know, we see images like this with faceless individuals, but basically going to fetch water from the well or the spring nearby at the time. They kind of added a romantic aura, if we can say, to the otherwise what should have been understood as the plight of the refugees in that sense. There were images that were clearly staged, and those staged images in the collection usually go back to the work of Myrtle rather than her boys, the other photographers, as we can see here, of life in the tent, where they're all looking in one direction. It's impossible, knowing Palestinian children, knowing children in general, but Palestinian children, that they could hold themselves from looking at the photographer or make faces, for that matter. But we start to see certain documentation of certain activities, perhaps staged in some cases in order to convey certain message, which I cannot be sure, but are they looking to the horizon for a better future? What did she intend with this particular setting? We also start to see images of events that related to the refugees. So 1967, the Arab-Israeli War of June 1967, in which Israel occupied the rest of historic Palestine along with lands from Egypt and Syria, the Golan Heights from Syria and Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, along with the Gaza and the West Bank. We saw an exodus of Palestinians once again from the occupied territories into the neighboring Arab countries, particularly into Jordan in this case. And the photographers of the UNRWA were there to document, because ironically, most of the UNRWA doesn't call them refugees. Those who left in 67 are displaced people. So the displaced people happened to be refugees from 48, who once again picked up and fled to Jordan. And we get to see a number of those images, including this one, for example, where when Israel for a short period of time allowed for the return of some of the refugees who left. This was all during the first month of the occupation, so we see celebrations of that. Now, in the collection, the main question that concerns me is, okay, this is a collection of photographs done by an institution. Can the Palestinians speak? Can we make the Palestinians represent themselves through those pictures that were never intended to represent the Palestinians? While I was working on this project, I found footage. This is from footage taken by the UNRWA photographers. They took also film of the bridge crossing to Jordan, the previous one, the same bridge, the broken bridge here. And this image showed among the people there, this young, beautiful woman. I'm gonna call her beautiful because apparently at some point she was designated as Jordan's beauty queen. So she's crossing with everyone else. While everyone else looked more like peasants in their outfits, she was actually had a short skirt, not mini skirt, but a short skirt. And the photographer, for some reason, focused on her. She stood out and, you know, went up and down. And I was showing this image, actually a friend of mine was showing this image to a group of us. And the minute he showed this image, two older gentlemen jumped from the audience and they said, "This is Janan." And they were obsessed with her. And apparently she was the beauty queen, I'm not using it officially here, of the town of Ramallah, where these guys were young men looking always, walking up and down the street looking at her. And all of a sudden, a film that was supposed to be about the plight of the refugees becomes a film about the adolescence memories of the two older men, professors at the time at Bir Zeit University. And all of a sudden, it's like, forget who took that picture and why. This is why this woman is so important. And one of them, Salim Tamari, ended up writing a text about this woman. Apparently, she moved on and eventually married a prince, Saudi prince, who became king, King Khalid, later on. But he apparently kept her a secret. So he bought her a house in London where the marriage was not announced. And after his death, the family, the Saudis, did not honor, they did not consider her part of the family. So she was suing them. So there was a whole story out there that started from this one photograph, one image, short image really, not more than 3 seconds, in a film, not film, that is present in the UNRWA archive. So in a way, I would say she spoke. She was out there. I mean, you know, and the images somehow that were not intended whatsoever to show the plight of the Palestinians or the life of Janan Harb, as her name is, found a way to speak through the memories of others. But in my case, I was obsessed with the very first photograph. I thought when I first saw this photograph, and I tend to treat photographs, aside from all the things I listed, who is the photographer, why did they take it, etc., etc., I try to deal with the photographs on different levels. And one is the surface level, where I say, okay, forget about everything you know about the historical conditions, important, of course, but let's see what does the photograph tell you. So I looked at this photograph. First of all, before looking at it, UNRWA photographs always had stamped on the back in stencil style, I don't know if some of you remember that, a caption. And unfortunately, I could not find in my collection the picture of the caption, so I retyped it here. What you get from the caption is really a description, and this is typical of all the captions, of the activity of UNRWA. Here we are told Nahr el-Bared refugee camp is near Tripoli. I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to read in details. And this picture was in 1952, as I mentioned earlier. And it sheltered Palestinians who fled from their homes in Palestine, etc., etc., in tents. You know, there's no adequate services, the tents are not so great, the winter is terrible. Right now, at that time, there were about 6,000 registered refugees there, and, you know, on and on. And this is more elaborate than some other ones. But basically, if we look at why did UNRWA take these photographs, based on their captions, they took them for institutional purposes. They were not really documenting the Palestinian experience. They were documenting the work of the agency. Now, if you look, and luckily I got the pictures in black and white, big size, where you can scan them and enlarge them. So from the surface examination of this photograph, I was able to identify a number of things through which I think, as a historian, I could use it to talk about Palestinian life in the refugee camp. First of all, the most obvious, the women in the picture, again, with the jars. So her very first picture was women with jars, and that's a theme that that kind of continued with her. The women with jars going to fetch water. They seem rather romantic, rather happy. You know, whether because they saw the photographer on the electric pole or something else, but there isn't anything particularly dramatic if you look at this element. The second thing is you notice that around each tent there are bamboo borders, borders made out of bamboo. So obviously the private space was created. So it's no longer just the refugees, now there are homes, even though they're tents, temporary, but they are there. And if we look at another one, which would be where, over there, I'm sorry, it's not so clear, you actually see within one of those bordered areas, a man, I imagine it's a man, but I cannot be certain, looks like an older man, planting. So he is resuming his activity. I mean, we have to remember, of course, that the people who ended up in the refugee camps were the peasants who came from the villages. City people, in general, integrated into the cities they went to. But part of the Palestinian trauma is that the village life was completely destroyed. And villagers became basically, what's the right term, like lived on the margins of cities, not part of the city, almost like lumpen proletariat. But some of their traditions on their ways of probably planting things he will eat, cucumbers or tomatoes or one of those things. So we see a vibrant activity. There is that. We also see behind the women other movement. We see the child ready to go to school, I would imagine, or maybe coming back from school. Also, we see other women, a woman and a child, I think, going home probably after they baked the bread or whatever food they had. We also see in the furthest corner over there on top a playground which looks like, careful examination of the picture, which is much clearer than the scan, shows that there is a authority figure, perhaps a teacher, and kids playing in a makeshift playground. So you look at this picture, first of all, it's a great picture. It has the aura of a romantic outing. Look at the mountains, the snow melting on top of the mountains, the clouds, indication probably of the beginning of winter. But there's something about the landscape that's inviting. And then you have all these people in tents, perhaps on an outing, having fun, and they're, you know, here the women are walking slowly. You have that whole aura. Of course, this has nothing to do with who those people, then we go to the larger historical context. But from this picture, as beautiful as it is, we're filled with small details here and there, I was able to, not me alone, but historians are able of Palestine to imagine a social life, an entire life. This is a beehive of activity in which there is a school, there are kids, there is a peasant. So there is a reincarnation, maybe reenactment of the life they were used to have in some sense or another. And that's where I think we can, through careful examination, and of course, as I stressed from the beginning and started with a historical overview, history is very important. But I think if you're going to make the picture speak, you need for a minute, and this is weird coming from a historian, but you need for a minute to examine the picture on its own. And let the picture tell you what's there. And then you add the historical context, and you can figure out things. So in a sense, I think examining the UNRWA photographs enables us to unearth a life completely forgotten. And Palestinian groups, organizations often do that. They do use images, unfortunately more along the porn element talked about yesterday, of we were people and we are refugees now, look at the hard life we live, which is all true. But in the 50s and 60s, these were the dominant images of the Palestinians before the Palestinian became the commando, the hero, the child throwing stones, and what have you. But there is a level of Palestinian nostalgia, almost, to this point, which is not exactly the history of Palestine. I mean, you would imagine that nostalgia will have to do with before their diaspora, so to speak. But in this case, this is also like beginning of the diaspora, but a continuation of the life known before. This is like a liminal period, which disappeared completely as the refugee camps are no longer places to plant. They are more of, slums on the sides of the cities that provide workers for the host country in one sense or another. I think with that, I'll just stop here and maybe we can elaborate through our discussion.